went from red numbers to green. That was a great exit in nine. Any kind of speed over 87, he's going to win the gold medal.
It's been a head-to-head fight with Francesco Friedrich. Canada, it's a tie! It is a tie!
Woo! Exciting stuff in Pyeongchang. The conclusion to the two-man bobsled competition. It was indeed a tie between Canada and Germany, and we're going to hear all about that later on in the program. But first, another guilty plea today in the Russia affair. Alex van der Zwaan, a lawyer linked to Trump associates Rick Gates and Paul Manafort, is pleading guilty to making false statements to investigators. Van der Zwaan worked for white shoe law firm Skadden Arps, which was hired by Ukraine's former president. That ex-president, Viktor Yanukovych, was pro-Russia and had hired Skadden to justify prosecuting the former prime minister for corruption. Van der Zwaan admitted to lying about communications he had with former Trump aide Rick Gates. Gates worked with former Trump campaign chief Paul Manafort, and Gates is also expected to change his plea to guilty today. He and Manafort are accused of money laundering, among other crimes. So here to untangle all of this is our regular legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. Hi there.
I think you just detangled it for us, actually.
I made it even worse because it's super confusing what with Ukraine, the formers and the exes, and who was working for whom, when. But let's begin with Alex van der Zwaan, working for Skadden Arps. What's he doing in Ukraine?
He's in the Ukraine or working in the Ukraine because Paul Manafort said basically, hey, can you help the Ukrainian Ministry of Justice report on one of my client's former rivals, is kind of the short way of saying that. And because lawyers work for clients, van der Zwaan said, yes, I can do that. And that actually wasn't the problem. So the work that he did in the Ukraine isn't what is at issue here. What's at issue is what's so often at issue in these big cases where someone gets ensnared is that it's false statements. That basically Robert Mueller's investigation had talked to van der Zwaan, and they said, when was the last time you talked to Rick Gates? And he was like, oh, I think we had an innocuous text exchange a while back. And as it turned out, they had had additional conversations after that and an additional email exchange, which I believe was never handed over and then lied about.
Ah, okay. So it's lying to the investigators. That's what ensnared him.
Exactly.
About these communications with Rick Gates. Now, Rick Gates, let's talk about him. He also worked on the Trump campaign, in fact, all the way through the transition. And he is expected to change his plea from not guilty to guilty today. And what is he accused of doing?
Well, basically, I think what he's going to plead guilty to is making false statements. Again, this is a popular term that we're going to, I think, continue to see when we talk about the Mueller investigation and money laundering. And so what we see here with respect to Rick Gates, I think, is someone who has talked to the Mueller investigation spoken with special counsel Robert Mueller and the people who work for him, and essentially come to the conclusion that they have a lot of evidence against him and that he either doesn't want to or cannot pay for a defense. And so what he will agree to is, I think, about 18 months in prison. And he will then potentially provide information on Paul Manafort. So in these types of big federal investigations, the special counsel isn't in the business of creating plea deals and plea bargains unless somebody has some information that is useful for the investigation to hand over. And that's when you get a lower sentence. Mm,
okay. And those two had been accused of some pretty serious crimes, not just lying, but money laundering, failing to register as a foreign agent. And so I guess so far, Paul Manafort is the biggest fish that Mueller has ensnared so far.
I think that's right. In terms of the size of fish, yes, I would rank Paul Manafort as the highest. He's our kind of daily special, so to speak. But, you know, everybody is potentially useful depending on how much information they have and on who they have it. And so what we're seeing is what we typically see for these big federal investigations. There's a methodical approach where you're going through a number of different people and trying to figure out what they know, when they knew it, and if and why they can provide useful information.
Right. And so all of this, though, is, I guess, the public is expecting this to be tied back in some way to Donald Trump or not. basically to say Donald Trump colluded or didn't collude with the Russians to become the next president of the United States.
Yes. I will say, one, we will never find evidence of collusion because collusion is a term that we use in antitrust law. We might find conspiracy. That's what we're looking for. And so I would say, yes, it may be that we find that evidence. It may be that we don't find that evidence. But that's what an investigation is about, as opposed to a witch hunt where you're just trying to find something to satisfy your conclusion. This is a real investigation where Robert Mueller and his team are looking at a wide variety of evidence, testimony from people, lots of documentary evidence, and they're figuring out whether or not there was an agreement between the Trump campaign and potentially the Trump administration and the Russian government. And the fact that there is no quote-unquote smoking gun yet actually makes me feel like Robert Mueller is doing his job. He's taking this seriously, and he's taking his time to go through and see if there's a there. And if there is not, you know, if at the end of the day, there's no quote-unquote smoking gun, there's no evidence that Donald Trump said to the Russian government, here's what we're going to do to fix the election, which is what I think people are waiting for, then it shows that the investigation worked as it should. If at the end of the day we find that there is that information, but it's not coming forward at this moment, then it still shows the investigation worked, because this is how those investigations proceed. You go person by person and document by document.
Okay. And speaking of, on Friday, we had this indictment of 13 Russians and the Internet Research Agency, basically accusing them of committing, political mischief in this country, of buying and implementing fake Facebook posts and Twitter posts and all that sort of stuff to sow confusion and to support Donald Trump at the expense of Hillary Clinton and others as well, Jill Stein and Bernie Sanders. So far, and Trump has said, there is no, and he used this word, collusion, there is no collusion between this in this indictment. There's no mention that Donald Trump was involved in any of this. So again, I think people are wondering, what does this have to do with the election of Donald Trump?
Well, the first thing I would say is yet. There's no evidence yet that there was a understanding or conspiracy between the Trump administration and these Russian foreign nationals who are, again, alleged to have created fake identities and essentially pumped an enormous amount of money into our system to try and sway our votes. And again, just because we haven't found it either means that it's not there or that we haven't found it yet. But both of those things are okay. It doesn't mean that the investigation is failing. It means the investigation is proceeding. And what's interesting, I think, about the indictment of these Russian foreign nationals is that it shows the type of information warfare that we can expect to see coming up in additional elections. I would say in the 2018 elections, we're going to see the same thing, because we are truly bringing a knife to a gunfight. We have not amped up in any sort of significant way to guard against this type of information warfare. And we've seen that it can be absolutely pervasive. And how many times have we talked to a voter and we've said, well, where did you find that out? Or where did you hear that? I saw it on Twitter. I read it on Facebook. And so it's not just the Russian government or Russian nationals who are watching this. It's other foreign governments and other outside organizations who say, you know what, that's a good way to try and influence the votes of American voters. And again, there's midterm elections right around the corner, and we are in no way prepared to guard against that.
All right. Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's a legal perspective. What about how this plays politically? Blake Hounshell is the editor of Politico magazine, and he recently wrote about his doubts about the Mueller investigation, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. All right. So why are you skeptical about this investigation? As we just heard, it is pretty much just starting to deliver indictments. It's hardly over yet. Why are you doubtful?
Well, I think all along I've been kind of wondering, as I look at the evidence that comes out in press reports and even in these indictments, and I think what we're all looking for is some kind of sign that President Trump or people close to him on his team actively collaborated with the Russians to tilt the election. We just haven't seen that so far. Even the indictments that came out on Friday, which were for 13 Russians who were involved in various social media efforts to swing voters in favor of Trump or just to create chaos in some cases, even those didn't seem to have any connection to anyone on the Trump campaign. There was this cryptic line from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who said that there weren't any knowing collaborators with the Russians among Americans. So, you know, I'm definitely open-minded. I'm waiting to hear if Mueller has any more. But so far, we haven't seen that kind of smoking gun evidence that Trump knew that he was working with the Russians in order to help him win.
Right. So far, though, you know, just to reiterate the first question, some people are saying, well, you know, be patient. It might come.
Well, it might. But then again, you know, it might not. I mean, think about how many leaks there have been that have been damaging to President Trump coming out of whether it's the Justice Department or from legal teams associated with defendants. I don't think Mueller's team leaks at all. But there's been an incredible volume of information that's been published in the press over the last year plus related to the Russia investigation. Stuff leaks out of the committees all the time. If there was something that was incredibly damning that linked President Trump directly to the Russians, I tend to think we would have heard about it by now.
Mm. And yet we have a bunch of his campaign aides who have been indicted or pleaded guilty or have been accused, and they are associated with the campaign. And so you could look at this and say, okay, well, they're starting with the small fish, and they're going to try to pressure those small fish to turn on the larger fish until they catch the largest fish.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's typically how these sorts of investigations of a conspiracy work, especially in the case of mafia cases or things like that. But as people who are familiar with these investigations have noted, usually when you do try to get plea deals or if you indict people for their involvement in a conspiracy, the best practice is you charge them with crimes related to the underlying conspiracy. And we don't have that so far. We have indictments against Paul Manafort and his deputy Rick Gates, who were the campaign manager and deputy campaign manager of the Trump campaign. But that's all been for influence peddling and money laundering related charges that don't have anything to do with the campaign. You know, Michael Flynn, who is briefly the national security advisor, he pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. And I tend to think that if Mueller had evidence that he was involved in some kind of conspiracy to tilt the election in favor of Trump colluding with the Russians, we would have heard about that by now.
What about these meetings with Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and some Russians promising damaging campaign information against Hillary Clinton?
Well, certainly the closest thing we have gotten so far to a smoking gun has been the email exchange between the British promoter that was working with the Russians to arrange the meeting and with Donald Trump Jr. saying, by the way, as you know, the Russians are working to elect your father and that we've got some Russians that want to provide dirt on Hillary Clinton. Are you up to meet with them? Don Jr. says, absolutely, I love it, especially if it's later in the summer. That's pretty damning. But so far from all the participants in the actual meeting, what we understand is that these Russians were talking about trying to get sanctions lifted related to the Magnitsky Act. You have some suspicious behavior from the Trump folks in covering up the true contents of that meeting. They initially claimed it was about adoptions. But so far, we haven't heard about that there was any follow-up. Don Jr. has said he found it disappointing, which suggests that he would have been game to collaborate with the Russians. Mm. But we just haven't seen any evidence that anything came out of that meeting, which is not to say that there isn't any. It's just from all the leaks we've had so far and from all the public statements of participants in that meeting, that's all we know.
Mm. Okay, so also today there is a pretty damning opinion piece put out by Tom Friedman in the New York Times, which is gone viral and gotten a lot of attention, where he leads the piece saying our democracy is in serious danger. And he goes on to say President Trump is either totally compromised by the Russians or is a towering fool or both. But either way, he has shown himself unwilling or unable to defend America against a Russian campaign to divide and undermine our democracy. And then the column goes on to point to raise some suspicions that he must have some reason for not coming down hard on Russia for interfering in the election, and that that might be financial interests, or that Russia has something on him, some compromising information on him, what have you. And, you know, granted, this is an opinion piece with no proof, but it seems to be that a lot of people on the left, at least, are thinking that there must be something there, because otherwise, why does Donald Trump so vociferously defend Vladimir Putin and Russia and refuse to crack down on this interference?
Well, I think it's a fair question, but it's also exactly why I wrote this piece expressing my skepticism. We have to do better than just supposition here. We're talking about the President of the United States and whether he committed actions that would be tantamount in some minds to treason. I think the bar is pretty high for making that kind of claim. I certainly think he's acted suspiciously, as I wrote in the piece. If Trump is guilty, he sure is acting like it. I do share some of Thomas Friedman's concerns about American democracy, but I would caution people not to lose their heads here. So far, the system has more or less held. Trump has obeyed court decisions. He has complained about the FBI and about the investigation, and Mueller is certainly looking into whether he obstructed justice. But, you know, so far he hasn't really challenged the rule of law in this country, which is not to say that he won't. And we have to be vigilant, but we also have to not exaggerate. And when we do exaggerate, we lose our credibility.
Blake Hounshell is editor-in-chief of Politico magazine. Thanks, Blake.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a leader in the Me Too movement became ensnared in her own sexual harassment scandal. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A leader in the Me Too movement here in California is facing new allegations that she, too, engaged in sexual misconduct. Not only does Christina Garcia chair the Women's Caucus, she was featured in Time Magazine's year-end issue as being one of the nation's silence breakers on sexual harassment. Well, now she's accused of urging her staffers to play spin the bottle after a fundraiser. She's on unpaid leave now. Carla Marinucci covers California politics for Politico. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for good for be with you, Madeline.
Okay. Great to have you. All right. So on Saturday, one of her former staffers said that he was fired after questioning the appropriateness of her asking her staffers to play spin the bottle. What is his story?
Yeah. David John Koenig worked in Christina Garcia's district office in Downey. He's 38 years old. He described to us sort of the evening of heavy drinking in which he said the assemblywoman ended up sitting on the floor of a hotel room with about half a dozen people and prompting them to play the spin the bottle game, which he said was definitely uncomfortable. He said that in the next days and weeks, his position in the office became increasingly tenuous as he kind of refused to play that game. And he was eventually fired. And now his attorney is charging he was fired as a direct result of sexual harassment. And he's just the latest in the sort of a group of legislative staffers who are telling us that they had experiences. One last week told us Daniel Fierro, an ex-staffer for Ian Calderon, told us that the assemblywoman groped him after a legislative softball game. He said she appeared to be inebriated. And Mr. Koenig, as well as a couple of other staffers who have signed on to an open letter, have suggested that drinking appears to be some kind of pattern, or at least they allege it's some kind of pattern with regard to Assemblywoman Garcia's behavior.
Okay, here's a clip of her defending herself on CBS News.
Daniel Fierro has said that you groped him at a softball game. Did that happen?
No.
What do you remember happening that day?
I was at the game, at the end of the game, and I left with some staff and with some members. And so, I have faith that the investigation will, make sure and have the facts come out and clear my name.
Okay, so there is an investigation.
Yes, there is. A complaint was filed. Mr. Piero's complaint was filed back in January. It looks like this is going to proceed now, and the Assemblywoman has taken a voluntary leave of absence as this proceeds.
Okay, so going back to David Koenig's his claim, now her ex-chief of staff says that he, the guy who's accusing her of, playing spin the bottle inappropriately, that this guy should release his own personnel records. So what's happening there?
Yeah, the latest development there is Mr. Reardon, Tim Reardon, the ex-chief of staff, said that he wanted to see Koenig release his personnel records. Then on Monday, someone did release David Koenig's personnel records on the Internet. I got a hold of a copy of it. That's prompted some outrage from folks like Christine Pelosi, who's head of the Democratic Women's Caucus, saying that that's going to have a chilling effect when you release personnel records, private records, confidential records of people who come forward with sexual harassment claims. That will have a chilling effect on anyone who wants to come forward. So right now, this is really roiling, I think, the Democratic Party, because the party is about to go into a state convention this weekend where, people are looking for endorsements, including Christina Garcia is looking for the endorsement of the party. At least for now, and could potentially be very embarrassing to the party as this unfolds this weekend.
Is there anyone challenging her politically for her seat?
At this point, some people have filed, yes. Her district is in Bell Gardens. That's her hometown. It looks like people have filed. I'm hearing from people who are filing. But she said this morning that she does not intend to step down from her spot, even though she has in the past. Suggested that other legislators who have been charged with sexual harassment step down. And we're watching Senator Tony Mendoza today, the results of an investigation on his sexual harassment issues should be released up in Sacramento. So this is all coming as these sexual harassment issues are unfolding in Sacramento. More and more legislators appear to be ensnared. So this is a developing story that continues, I think, to disturb the political landscape in the state capitol.
Well, speaking of disturbing the political landscape, let's talk about this interesting political development. Amanda Renteria has entered the governor's race. Few people have heard of her, but she worked for Javier Becerra. She worked for Hillary Clinton. And there are some suspicions about why she entered the race. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. This may be one of the strangest entries into the California governor's race that we've ever seen. Amanda Renteria has a stunning resume. I mean, she graduated from Harvard. She has an MBA. She graduated from Stanford as well. She is somebody who was the first Latina chief of staff in the U.S. Senate. She worked for Senator Feinstein and Senator Stabenow. And now, as you mentioned, for Becerra. But her jump into the governor's race last week came with no campaign announcement, no website, no money, apparently, no staff, no strategist, nothing. 4 months before a governor's race, that's a highly unusual thing to do, especially in California, where it takes millions of dollars to do that. There was some suggestion that some political game playing was at stake here or was in play, that perhaps someone was trying to steal votes away from Antonio Villaraigosa, who's, of course, former Los Angeles mayor, prominent Latino politician, and who is really campaigning for votes in the Central Valley. That is exactly where Amanda Renteria is from. She ran for Congress against David Valadao in 2016. She lost by 15 points, but there's a suggestion that maybe she is trying to somehow affect the race in that way, or that she's trying to prepare the ground for some future race. The fact is, people are kind of scratching their heads, and that she is talking to the press today. We're going to be hearing from her, and she's already saying that she wants to present sort of a hopeful, positive message for the governor's race. It's going to be interesting to watch. As a Latina woman who has a lot of political experience, as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton's national political director in 2016. She's already getting a lot of attention. So this could be something that just establishes her as a name in California, something that she didn't have before.
So not necessarily a political stalking horse for Gavin Newsom to split the Latino vote.
Yeah, I mean, Newsom's campaign absolutely denies that and says, look, she's accomplished on her own. She doesn't need to be manipulated by any guys in this race. And I think there's no question that as a Latina, as a Central Valley politician, she will steal some votes away from both Delaine Easton, the other Democratic woman in the race, and Villaraigosa. And if she does that, that could mean in the top two primary, a Republican ends up as number two. Mm. That would be definitely a benefit for Gavin Newsom.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned. Thanks, Carla.
Okay. Thank you.
Carla Marinucci covers California politics for Politico. Coming up, actress Laurie Metcalf is here to talk about her Oscar-nominated performance in Lady Bird, the return of Roseanne, and why she still hesitates to take on TV and movie roles.
I have a camera phobia, so that's hard to work around. I use up way too much of my energy trying to look like I'm not afraid of the camera.
Laurie Metcalf is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the film Lady Bird, Christine, whose given name is Lady Bird, as in she gave herself that name, is a high school senior who wants to fly far away from her hometown of Sacramento as soon as she graduates high school.
I want to go where culture is,
but
like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or at
a
least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
well,
where
you
writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
the way
enough.
That you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Lady Bird, played by Saoirse Ronan, just bailed out of her mom's moving car right there. Her mom is played by Laurie Metcalf, who is perhaps best known for her award-winning performance as Aunt Jackie in the TV sitcom Roseanne. Well, she's now getting tons of attention, including an Oscar nomination for playing Lady Bird's critical but loving mom, Marion. And Laurie Metcalf joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you.
Well, I want you to talk about that scene a little bit.
Yeah.
And in general, what it reveals about your character and her, tough love and her conflicted emotions there. What is it about Lady Bird that wounds Marion so much?
Oh, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. She's craving to see her daughter succeed in anything that she tries, and it's hard for a parent to see a child not live up to to the parents' expectations. There's an exchange later in the movie that mothers and daughters have quoted to me. You know, as they watch the movie together, the mother says, "I just want you to be the best version of yourself that you can be," and Lady Bird asks her mom, "Well, what if this is the best version?" And it's to Greta's credit, you know, these lines are very they're very delicate. They just sort of come in and nothing's being hit over the head. You know, you're not being pounded over the head with a message or anything, but they reverberate. And a lot of those exchanges have stayed with me. But I loved hearing the playback of that scene because I'm reminded of how fun it was to work on it, to get it up to speed and to be able to do all those overlaps and make it sound really messy. And it sounds, sometimes people have asked us if there was any improvisation during the movie, but there wasn't at all. So I just love that it was so meticulously scripted by Greta Gerwig.
Yeah. Well, let me play another messy cut then, because we have it ready. I just want to hear it again. This is when you're making a rushed breakfast for the family with a Ladybird's there. The dad, your husband, played by Tracy Letts, is there. The adopted brother, his girlfriend.
Why can't I just make the eggs?
Because you take too long, you make a big mess, and I have to clean the whole thing up.
Eggs aren't good for the environment anyways.
What?
You heard her.
Eat quickly, please.
Look at all these pictures. Every newspaper looks like USA Today.
Shelley and I are trying to be vegan. Hence the soy milk.
You wear leather jackets.
But they're vintage, so they don't support the industry.
They aren't done. There's white stuff.
You know how much you love brambles? Pigs are smarter than him, even.
I never thought brambles was a genius, okay? Mom, the eggs are not done.
Fine, make your own eggs.
I wanted to. You won't let me.
Your sister doesn't like me.
I'm hungry.
She does.
There's your chance. Go into bed.
That just seems so real. I mean,
it does. I know, and it was again. It was so fun to work on it, and it was like a piece of music, you know, especially mm-hmm. with that many people in that scene and in a tiny little quarters. Really fun.
And if you could talk about that, you know, almost last scene where you're at the airport and she's going off to college, and it's. It's really moving. You get in a fight with her, and then you realize that you probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, well, there's a time jump between when my character finds out that she's gone behind my back and has applied to and been accepted to a school across country. And so I think that we have, you don't see this time, but we haven't spoken in months, probably for the whole summer. And then all of a sudden it's time for her to go. And her parents, you know, naturally drive her to the airport, and my character refuses to go inside and, you know, is playing the martyr and just won't budge. You know, they both have a stubborn streak in them, and then as soon as I remember pulling out of away from the airport, and I literally could see Saoirse and Tracy in the rearview mirror just standing there on the sidewalk at the curb with the bags. And then my character was about to make this literal journey, driving the car around, you know, and then and deciding to come right back again and see if she could rush in and say a final goodbye to her daughter after all that time and missing out.
Yeah. So you have had a very long career, mainly, on stage and on TV, not so much in the movies, right?
No, hardly. No, I've only done a handful of movies. Saoirse was my mentor on the set because she has so much more film experience than I do. I hadn't done a movie in 10 years, and when I did, it was just a tiny little one-day part. So besides that, it probably goes back another 10 years.
Yeah.
It just wasn't ever on my radar, really. I just had always was in doing theater, no matter what. And then Roseanne came about.
Yeah, and you're going to reprise your role as
yes,
Aunt Jackie.
Yes, we are. Yes, we did. We shot 9 episodes, and I hope that people respond to it. You know, it felt like a big responsibility for all of us. We took it very seriously, you know, because people grew up watching the show, and some of the fans are so devoted to it. And you know, you want to do it justice, of course. And I think that the writers wrote really true to the characters, and I think that the storylines they're sort of a natural extension of what the stories used to be, which were mostly small-ish stories about the family.
Right.
But it's so great to see the Connors, who everybody knows, plucked up and dumped into 2018, and what are they up to?
Uh-huh. And when one of them is a Trump supporter, and that would be Roseanne. And raised a few eyebrows, because I guess in real life she is a Trump supporter. Does that come into the I mean, does your character argue with her about that?
Yeah, we deal with it in the episode number one, because how can you not? But what I think the writers were so, not clever, but they just embraced it as a way to show a lot of the rifts that were caused during the election between families. And so there is one between the two sisters, Jackie and Roseanne. And yet, you know, when we talk about the election and it, you know, how can we not in the episode, but it boils down to what's down deep between these two sisters that has caused them not to speak to each other for a whole year.
Mm. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about the choice of characters that you have made, the choices that you've made over the years, because it does seem that a lot of your characters, be it Marion, be it Jackie, be it Dr. Jenna James in Getting On, or even the play right now, Three Tall Women, the Edward Albee play, where you mm-hmm. are playing women who have complicated relationships with other women, not necessarily with men. And I'm wondering if that is something that you consciously choose to do, is to have to play roles where the primary relationships or the primary action involves women.
Well, no, it's not been a choice. I've just had to, you know, as an actor, I'm just at the mercy of, you know, literally being hired, you know, from role to role. And but I seen, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way. Of course, Jenna James was dealing with the nurses who were under her, and Jackie and Roseanne is in, for me, you know, the main relationship in Roseanne. But it kind of started with Getting On. I just started getting this really, really rich material coming my way. And, you know, for an actor, that's just like crack, you know. It makes you start to salivate. You just can't wait to tear into it and pick it apart and start working on it. It gets all those creative juices flowing. But the roles that I gravitate to are mostly sort of, you know, blue collar, and, you know, where my comfort zone seems to be, coming from Illinois. And I've just been lucky also to be able to bounce around between film, TV, and stage. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for that, because I'm really afraid to get burnt out on any one of them, because that would be a real shame. Because it's my job, but it's also, like everything to me.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about your Getting On character, Dr. Jenna James?
I miss that show so much.
I do, too.
I loved it.
It
was on HBO, and we ended up doing, 12 of them, I guess. And it was just, we knew that we had lightning in a bottle on that show, because just the writing was superb. The casting was so great. The storylines were excellent. It was a hard sell. I get that, you know, because it was three women, a doctor and two nurses working in a geriatric ward at a slightly run-down hospital.
You do know that there's a fecal deposit on that chair?
Yes, we are on top of that.
Is it mine?
And that doesn't sound funny.
Not a great elevator pitch right there.
Right. No. But it had heart. It had a little bit of everything.
And really funny. Very, really dark comedy.
Surprising and very, very dark comedy. I loved it.
I mean, she's sort of different from the other characters that you've played.
She certainly has a hideous bedside manner, which I find very, very funny and fun to play.
Tell us a bit more about how you got into acting through the theater, because you were at Illinois State University, right, when you...
Yeah, and I fell in with a group of kids. We were just a bunch of theater geeks who wanted to do some plays over the summer. And so we went up to Highland Park, Illinois, and we found a church basement that charged us a dollar in rent, and we built some risers in there and put some, you know, folding chairs on the risers, and we did 4 1-acts, and we thought, all right, that'll be it for the summer. And then cut to 45 years later, and you know, Steppenwolf is this great institution in Chicago, and we've been able to take plays all over the place. And I would never have done it without them. I don't think I would have been thick-skinned enough to do it on my own, to venture out and go to a couple of auditions, say, in St. Louis, Missouri, and get rejected, and then just decided, oh, well, I shouldn't be an actor anyway, so I'll put that to bed. So I owe everything to Steppenwolf and the group of us who started out.
And which includes Gary Sinise and John Malkovich, mm-hmm. Joan Allen.
Mm-hmm. Terry Kinney. Jeff Perry, uh-huh. Glenn Headley.
Yeah, and so do you still perform with Steppenwolf?
I do. I haven't been back in 2 years now. I took a little one act back there not that long ago. I mean, 2 years is a long time, but it's hard, you know, when to do a play, you have to commit way ahead of time, and you also have to set aside at least 5 months. And so it's hard logistically to always make it work out, but I'm always looking for what my next play in Chicago will be. It's home, you know.
Do you prefer theater overall?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have more experience doing theater, so that's more my comfort zone. I'm still learning film. I have a camera phobia, so that's hard to work around. I use up way too much of my energy trying to look like I'm not afraid of the camera. It's just annoying. You'd think I'd be over it by now, having done, you know, 200 and something episodes of Roseanne with a camera right in my face. But those tape days are very stressful to me.
Well, what is it about the camera that freaks you out?
Just that there's a permanent record and I just feel more free on stage. I don't know. I've got to psych myself out of this in some way, but I don't know. I think it's a losing battle at this age. I don't think that's going to happen.
But you'll still accept roles, meaty roles, when they're offered to you to be in front of the camera.
Yes. I'm more wary of accepting parts that are in front of a camera.
All right. Well, Laurie Metcalf, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
That's Laurie Metcalf. She's nominated for an Academy Award for her role as Marion in Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird. And she'll be in Roseanne, which airs on March 27th. Coming up, the beauty of the bobsled. A resident Norwegian is here to talk about that at the Winter Olympics next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Any kind of speed over 87, he's going to win the gold medal. Canada, it's a tie! It is a tie!
Yes, Canada and Germany tied for gold last night in the two-man bobsled. A Latvian team got the bronze. The best U.S. team? Well, it finished 14th. That's the men. On the women's side, the U.S. has two strong medal contenders. One of those teams features an athlete from Los Angeles. Her name is Lauren Gibbs. And here to tell us more about her and the sport of bobsled is Press Play's resident Norwegian producer, Christian Bordahl. Hi.
Hey there.
So how are the Norwegians doing on the bobsled track?
There are no Norwegians, Madeline, on
what?
The bobsled track, okay? In fact, I was curious about this, and I looked back in the history of it, and the Norwegians... There has never been a Norwegian who medaled.
Do they just disdain the bobsled? Leave it to the Jamaicans?
I don't know. Maybe they just don't have any. Well, there is a track, I guess, now in Lillehammer because they had the Olympics there, but they're not very good at it.
Oh, okay. No. Well, all right. So the men had that tie in the gold.
Yeah.
That seemed unusual, right?
You know, it's incredible when you think about it. They have the way bobsled works is you have four heats. And so they add up all of the times of all four heats and to determine who went fastest over four heats. And the track is almost a mile long. So by the time they've done four heats, they've done like 3.5 miles on these things. They are measuring the time to the hundredths of a second. So 1 second divided up into 100 little tiny slivers.
Yeah.
That's how they find the time. And yesterday, in the men's two-man bobsled, after three heats, the top five teams were all within 1/13 of a second of each other. So the top team and the fifth team was only 1/13 of a second behind the top team. It was incredible. And the funny thing is, though, that last time Canada won a gold medal in two-man bobsled was 20 years ago, and they tied then. They tied an Italian team. So it does happen, but it's pretty rare.
Oh, okay. All right. So tell us about this woman from Los Angeles, Lauren Gibbs.
Yeah. So Lauren Gibbs, she was a sprinter in high school. She played volleyball at Brown University. As a grown-up, she was seriously into CrossFit. And then 4 years ago, at about age 30, at CrossFit, that is where her Olympic career began.
I was, working a corporate job in Denver, Colorado, and I was working out at a CrossFit gym called Front Range CrossFit, and a good friend of mine, Jill Potter, who was a 2016 rugby Olympian, approached me as I was back squatting, and she was like, hey, how much do you back squat? And I was like, 375, and she was like, okay.
Yes. She squats 375 pounds, and that's before she started training for the Olympics.
And then she came back. She's like, how much do you deadlift? And I was like, 425. She's like, okay. Then she came back and she was like, can you sprint? And I was like, Jill, what's the deal? She's like, I think you should bobsled. And I was like, what? She's like, yeah, I think you should try out for the U.S. bobsled team. And I was like, Jill, people don't actually do that. And she's like, no, it's an Olympic sport. And I was like, no, it's not.
Yes, it is. So she goes to the tryout. She does really well. They send her to a week-long camp at Lake Placid Training Center in New York. Before you know it, she's on the national bobsled team competing in races all over the world.
Oh, my gosh. And she is a break person?
She is a break person, yes. A break man or a break woman. Yes, she sits behind the driver or the pilot.
What does she do?
So, basically, they call it a brake person or they call it a push athlete, and those are the two things she does. At the beginning of the race, she pushes really hard the sled, and they get going as fast as they possibly can. She jumps into the sled, and then she has to tuck down, and she can't even look. She's
just hope for the best.
That's right. She can't even poke her head up to look because that would be more wind resistance, right? So she has to tuck down and then just hope for the best, and then at the end, she pulls the brake. And obviously, you have to be really powerful, which she is, and you also have to be fast. So they train like lifters, but they also train as sprinters. And Lauren is really, really good at both.
And they need to leap in to provide more weight. So
exactly.
It goes
faster. Yeah.
So how fast does the bobsled go?
They can go anywhere from like 85 to 95 top speed miles an hour. I was listening last night. The men were doing a top speed of about 87, as the guy was saying in that soundbite.
So what's it like in there?
Yes, I actually asked her about what is it like doing that, and what was it like when you first got started doing this? Here's what she had to say.
Being in the back of a bobsled is nothing like going down a water slide or a roller coaster. It's kind of like being kicked off a cliff in a trash can. So you're kind of getting bounced back and forth. A bobsled will go anywhere from 75 to 95 miles an hour. Now, it's just like any day at the office. My first ride down, I thought, what the heck is happening? And that whole first year, I was terrified. Every time I got in the back of the sled, I was just absolutely terrified. I was terrified to run downhill on ice. I was terrified to be in a sled. I was terrified to flip the sleds because the sleds are really expensive. They're BMW sleds. They're probably $100,000 to $150,000 per sled. And I was like certain I was going to break one or it was going to fall on me.
Here's a wacky thing that I learned from Lauren. When they're training, they only get to spend like 2 minutes a day actually going down the track in the sled. Just because I guess it's really hard on the body and there's these big sleds and it takes a lot of effort. And so she told me she spent probably about like 10, 12 minutes with Alana Myers Taylor, the pilot that she's working with at Pyeongchang, actually in the sled going down a track together. The rest of the time, they're just doing the weight training and the sprinting and all that kind of stuff.
It doesn't really sound that fun. I mean, a trash can being beaten up with these high G-force, I don't know.
It's the Olympics, Madeline.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, what about the Jamaicans? We all want to know. Are they back?
Right. The Jamaicans, I'm afraid there's no Jamaican four-man sled this year. There is a Jamaican two-woman sled. But they probably are not really medal contenders, but they are there.
Okay, and they're on tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, speaking of four and two-man sleds, there is no four woman sled. We've been talking about the male female thing at the Olympics. Yeah, so no four woman sled. There's only a two woman sled. The men get a two man and a four man.
Any explanation for that?
You know, it's still early in the days. You know, the women only started at the Olympics in 2002, so I guess they're still developing enough athletes to make it worthwhile having four-man or four-woman sleds as well as two-woman sleds.
Okay, so we can watch Lauren tonight.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much, Press Play producer and resident Norwegian, of course.
You're very welcome.
Just during the Olympics, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.